Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm thrilled and honored to have as my guest today Jim Harrison, and we'll be discussing Mr. Harrison's new book, Saving Daylight, published by Copper Canyon Press, and we'll also discuss The Summer He Didn't Die, published by Grove Atlantic. He also has available currently True North and Off to the Side. So first of all, Jim, thank you very much for your time today.
Fine. I'm sitting here in Montana looking at sheep, which is pleasant.
Yes. You've had a prolific last few years, with beginning with Off to the Side, the memoir you wrote in 2002, followed by True North, then The Summer He Didn't Die, which was a collection of novellas, and now Saving Daylight, a book of poetry. And that's quite an output of work in a 4 or 5 year period of time.
Well, actually, I've written another novel during the serial, the continuation of True North. I finished this spring. They wanted to bring it out in October, but I said no, that's too fast. You get to the point you're competing with your own market, so they're going to bring it out late next winter.
Oh, well, good. Good. Jim, with Saving Daylight, one of the things that always strikes me when I see a new Jim Harrison book are the dust jackets are so gorgeous. And your relationship with Russell Chatham, when did that develop? Because I feel that your books are worth the price of the cover just for the art on the cover, and then you get inside the book and get the prose, which obviously is what the reader's buying. But your relationship with Russell, how did that develop, and how do you select the paintings that you're going to use on the covers?
Well, that happened. I met Russell actually in 68. I knew Tom McGuane and the novelist quite well, and Russell was a friend of his from Molinas, California. And his grandfather's a well-known California painter named Gottardo Piazzoni. I just loved Russell's work, so as soon as I had the cloud, I made sure Russell had cover control, as they call it, of any of my books, because I actually majored in art history for a while, and to me, the book as a physical object is very important.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And with Russell's taste. Oh, I go through a lot of slides or remember paintings. I think I own 14 Chatham paintings. And I just pick them out that way.
You know, wonderful.
I just look at them.
Yeah, and I remember in Jackson, Mississippi in 1988, you were at Lemuria Bookstore for doing a signing for Dalva, and I was standing next to a rather tall guy, and I said, I just love the dust jackets of Mr. Harrison's books, and he said, thank you. And it ended up I was talking to Russell, and he told me the story of Dalva and how the dust jacket came to be.
Uh-huh.
And it was kind of a funny story. And it was the story he told me about running into a waitress at a restaurant in Mexico.
Yeah. Well, Russell has an affection for, an unparalleled affection for waitresses, you know. I was just with him of all things out at the Hearst Ranch, and Russell's not changed. You know, artists, painters in general are much more vivid people than writers, you know.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like that Rilke line, you know, painters are more part of the creature world. I always think of them that way. They're looking outward all the time, while writers are always looking inward.
Yes, yes.
And Russell's eye, particularly, is more, what's that old French idea? There's more of a correspondence with his eye and my work than I find in other artists.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you could get, if you don't interfere a little bit, you can get totally bum-wad covers. I remember when they brought out a bunch of my novels in England, and the covers were absolutely atrocious, you know.
Jim, one of the things I notice in Saving Daylight, and that you write about in a lot of your work, is it seems to me that you've learned an awful lot in your life from dogs, haven't you?
Yeah, I don't know. I tell people this question. Yes, we are not alone. You know that idea, and I remember when I was very, very young, you know, 5 or 6, I asked my dad the difference between us and animals, and he just said, well, not much, just animals live outside and we live inside.
Mm-hmm.
So my dogs live in the house. But I think it's partly the sense that this Hasidic scholar said to me, that reality is an accretion of the perceptions of all creatures, not just us, you know. So if you're feeling blue, you know, just act like a dog for a day. You know, the Cheyenne Indians used to do that. They'd follow their dog around all day and just do whatever the dog did, you know. It was partly out of that whole system of what they call, the Sioux called it, Heyoka, spiritual renewal. So, when in doubt, become a dog.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And give biscuits to stray dogs. I like that.
Something like that, or a bird, you know, just
yeah.
About anything works.
Yeah.
I've never, only a couple times, really gotten into the idea of being a snake. You know, it's just more difficult, you know.
Yeah. And Jim, when you mentioned your father explaining the animal world to you, when I read your memoir Off to the Side, which I'm very glad that you wrote that, and I think that aspiring writers would do well to read your book, which tracks the life your life as a writer, beginning as a poet, and going through the process of becoming a writer. And ending up in Hollywood and all that entailed. But one thing that struck me was when you told your father, I believe you were 16 years old, you told your father you wanted to be a writer, and he went out and he bought you a used typewriter. And that was a very noble gesture, I felt, because I've talked to a lot of writers whose fathers felt that was not something that you should be.
Well, you know, it's partly, I always really appreciated that, because so many writers get exhausted by just that opposition of the father. You know, it's mentally extremely wearing. You know, I've noticed in writers. So, you know, when I wrote True North, and since my own father was so benign, I sort of researched evil fathers, and relatively evil fathers, and I came up with about a dozen I had known, and that was part of the book, just how wearing then the succession is to the son, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know a mind doctor very well in New York, and he has 70-year-old patients that are still in a state of turmoil about their fathers.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I was lucky that mine was so supportive, but then again, though, he was an agriculturist, you know, an agronomist. He was extremely widely read.
Yes, yes. And
that again is helpful if you have someone that a parent who's behind you. My mother less so. She kept wondering why, if I was going to be a writer, shouldn't I try to write something for Collier's Mate? You know, honey, you know that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was my mother, who's 100% sweet, who said a few years before she died, she said, "You made quite a living out of your fibs." Isn't that wonderful?
That is.
I love that kind of thing.
You know, And Jim, when I interview writers, I like to make reference to a couple works maybe that quite aren't as well known. And in Legends of the Fall, you wrote a novella called The Man Who Gave Up His Name, and in that novella, you discussed the French philosopher talking about the terrible freedom that losing your father offers you. And I lost my father when I was 18, and I understood when I read The Man Who Gave Up His Name when you published it, and I was rereading it again the other day, and I understood it even more at my age now. And that's a really kind of a fascinating concept, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's that strange thing, you know, went back to animals. It's like, what was the Barbara Kingsolver says? We have to figure out what it's like to be a mammal in human clothing, but you lost the pack leader, as it were. And in cases of father, the only possible meaningful judge is gone, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I lost mine when I was like 22 when he died with my sister in a car accident. And you're certainly adrift for a while, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then you're also autonomous.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And there's really, you're not looking for anyone's acceptance.
That kind of influence on you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was, when I reread The Man Who Gave Up His Name, I think there are a lot of people in the post-9/11 world that are feeling that way now. They're questioning a lot about their life. And Yeah. So, I mean, I would recommend that everybody go back and reread The Man Who Gave Up His Name, because this is a character, Nordstrom, who had the courage to change his life.
Well, yeah, because... You know, there's this question of, McGuain put it succinctly, typical Irish wit, you end up doing what other people want you to do or what you want to do. You know, it's harder for most people, you know, I admit, it's harder for most people because after you receive your calling as a writer, which can happen rather early, then you have a built-in structure to your life that other people don't get, often don't get, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like these young people you meet are so obsessed with the pure sciences. Well, they've got it not, because already they have a structure that they find very appealing.
Mm-hmm.
So there is actually some similarity.
Yeah, and we were discussing before we went on the air. We were discussing the book Farmer, which you wrote in 1976, and it was made into what I think was a very fine film called Carried Away, starring Dennis Hopper and Amy Irving. And again, that's another film and book I highly recommend. I think that was done in 76. The book that I think has stood the test of time very well. In fact, Jim, all your books are still in print, aren't they?
Yeah, basically, I think they all are, and I'm pleased that I think I'm up to 29 countries now. In fact, I just had a letter from people who are translating my work into Catalan. Some has been translated into Spanish, but having been in Barcelona and Couillère, France, just across the border. Couillère, France is interesting, almost alarming, because it's a combination Basque, Catalan, French, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Food has more punch. They even use hot peppers. And some of their seafood dishes remind me of what I've eaten in Veracruz, in Mexico, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating. But I suppose some migrated in that direction. But I love Barcelona. So
yes, and we're gonna do some poems from your new collection, Saving Daylight, here in just a moment here, and like I say, with congratulations on having all the books in print, because a lot of books these days have the shelf life of a ripe tomato. So that's
well, you sort of accrete an audience. You know, I've never been a big seller, really big seller, but unlike in France, where I've had actually had 4 books on the bestseller list, but who knows why. You gradually accrete an audience, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then they tend to stay with you, you know.
Yes, and the fact that your the quality of your prose has always been at the highest level is also the other factor. Jim, do you have a copy of the new book in front of you, Saving Daylight?
Sure.
Let's go to page 43, a poem you wrote called Alcohol. And if you would you please?
Yeah, this is one from the heart.
Yeah, how about reading that one for us?
Okay, Alcohol. In the far back room of the school for young writers, are too big, illegal formaldehyde glass jars holding the kidneys and livers of Faulkner and Hemingway among the tens of thousands of empty bottles of everything they drank to fuel themselves through their bloody voyages. Alive, their arms were crooked out as question marks trying to encircle the world. Dead, they are crazy old men who convinced us of the reasonableness of their tales, their books deducted from their caskets at the last possible moment. And now we hold them tightly as if they ever truly cared. No one should wish to enter this room, but still some of us hurl ourselves against the invisible door as if our stories in alcohol were Siamese twins, ineluctably joined at the head, our hearts enlarged until they can barely beat.
Thank you. I read that poem and I was just stunned.
Well, there is, running through literary history in all countries, there's sort of an affection for booze or wine or whatever. Even in France, when I found out I'd visited this restaurant with a secret room where Balzac used to hang out, the secret room was where he could escape his creditors, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They tip him off at the door. But he would sometimes drink 3 bottles of wine for lunch, you know, so. And I think Whitney writes 57 novels, so it didn't decrease his productivity, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, obviously Steinbeck and Faulkner and Hemingway did have their particular dependencies, whatever they call them now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But they wrote well, so.
Yes, they certainly did.
Yeah.
And then, Jim, how about page 55, Mother Night?
55. Sandhill cranes across the road, burble of irrigation ditch. understand mortality. Look at birds. Blue moon, two full moons this month, which I conclude are two full moons. In what direction do the dead fly off the earth? Rising sun, 1,000 blackbirds pronounce day.
That's beautiful. Jim, in Saving Daylight by Copper Canyon Press, you have had several of the poems translated into Spanish. And just so the listeners know, I'll be doing a separate show where what I'm going to do is just do a little narrative about the book, and I'll read the books and translate it in Spanish, in both English and Spanish, for the Latin American audience. And what was your thinking behind actually offering the poems in the book in Spanish and in English?
Well, I live for 16 years. It's not far from, you know, where Louis Urie is from, Nogales.
Mm-hmm.
Nogales is just about 20 miles from my house. And I've read, you know, that's, to me, the Spanish own 20th century poetry. I mean, there's been good ones elsewhere, but if you think of the enormity, why was it here, France last year was to try to stupidly find the lost poems of Antonio Machado, you know, when he had to flee Franco, he lost the Belize that had 4 years of his work in it, you know, which to me was a preposterous loss to the world of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And now on a recent trip, I just went down to see where I had, ever since I was 18, which is a long time ago, I'd wanted to see where Garcia Lorca was executed. So I walked to Guadalquivir in Seville, and then I went down to Granada on the train, and had this incredibly antique cab driver that took me out to the little stand of pine trees above this gully where Lorca was executed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Evidently he was shot repeatedly in the ass because he was gay, that's what they say. And then they shoved him over the cliff, you know, along with a number of others. So I don't know Spanish poetry. And perhaps you know that big anthology that Michael Weigers and Monica De La Torre did called Reversible Monuments, Contemporary Mexican Poetry.
Mm-hmm.
That's an incredible book. You know, if you read Francisco Hernandez's poem, long, long poem about Walter Schumann. That's one of the great poems of our time. Plus, my best student, the 1 year I taught, whom I've kept in touch with, was Elliot Weinberger, who translated all the work of Octavio Paz.
Mm-hmm.
But say, living on the border, right,
mm-hmm.
where even the waiter at the Mexican restaurant where I visit several times a week, because they have the best machaca in the world. It's called Las Vegas in Nogales. Anyway, even the waiter, Alphonse, knows Spanish poetry. So it's much more sort of less separate in their lives.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, the generation of 1898 produced that class of Spanish writers, really. I mean, their work today is still incredible.
Well,
rate.
True, you know, but that's even true in the novel. I got roundly criticized in America for saying in the New York Times that the American novel right now is only an island in the sea of Marquez.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
Which I feel is true. You know,
yeah.
We don't have anyone in that category.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Jim,
there you have it. But anyway, so I had to. I've been somewhat obsessed with it without the language, too, because I'm horrid about language, except Michigan English, I call it.
was reading Jim's memoir off to the side, he made a reference in the book to the term magical realism, which has always offended me, as if, and I think part of what it is, my friend Andre Debuse used to say that in the U.S. we're too obsessed with first world problems and we're not citizens of the world, and the term magical realism, I think, reflects that worldview.
Well, I agree. It irks me because, you know, I've met waiters at Veracruz that have more imagination than any English professor I've ever met. You get what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
In the same way in Zihuatanejo where I go fishing. So I don't get it. It's just the way the world is looked at. You know, in our culture, perception is totally controlled by the culture, so you have to get out of the box of your culture until as little as possible you even recognize it, you know. So this whole idea of magical realism is absolutely nonsense.
Yeah, I think it's a lazy term. So Jim, on page 63, you have Sonoran Corrida for the band Los Humildes.
Yeah.
So if you would.
I got obsessed years ago. There's this Sonoran band, Los Humildes, that I put one of their lyrics in Dalva because she listens to it when she's staying with her uncle, you know, one of those songs that starts, you know, two horses, two friends, two pistols, one woman, and then they start screaming, of course, because everybody knows the end of the story. But they're very powerful. And I got this idea of those writing corridos because I love the Lorca's gypsy ballads that much, and then you hear I can make out a lot of Spanish on the traditional radio stations, of which there are many down there. And they sing these songs about love and torment and poverty and the drug industry and so on and so on. It's sort of almost street music, but infinitely more lyrical, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought I would write some and eventually have a band do them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Which I would love to hear, you know.
Sure.
You want me to read that one?
Yeah, please.
Okay, Sonoran Corrida. When she sang her song, even rabbits and mad dogs listened. She lived in a tin shack halfway up a mountain near Caborca. She was only 12, raised by a brother who one Friday went to Hermosillo to cheat the rich and powerful who had stolen his crop. 3 days three nights she waited with her heart in her throat. At the end of their path down to the dusty road that led to Caborca, it was hot and she was drinking the air in sobs when a truck drew up and threw her a bag with the cold devil's laughter. In the bag were her brother's tongue and finger with his ring made of a horsehair nail. Now she would become a horror star, but she cut her wrist to join her brother. If you wish to cheat the rich and powerful, you must do it with a gun.
Amen.
That's how they look at things.
Yes, yes. Jim, one of the things that, that again, referring to the memoir off to the side, there were a couple times in your life where other writers or other artists were generous with you, and I was particularly touched that you mentioned that Richard Brautigan loaned you the money to write Farmer, which I found pretty incredible.
Yeah, that always goes back and forth, and even when I broke, I paid it back, stuff like that, but, you know, everybody knows the gift for a writer always is time. You know, and that's
yes.
One thing you can occasionally buy. So if somebody gives you, you know, like Scott Nicholson giving me enough money to finish Legends. It's that's what you need, because of course, like every other writer I've worked, it's hard to write if you're laying blocks all day.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things you said about Nicholson, you said many people can afford to behave this way, but very few actually do.
Well, that's true, because of course, sometimes generosity of that respect has suddenly the bee swarm arrives.
Yes.
You know, that kind of thing. So people may feel more comfortable giving to charities than to individuals.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's difficult. Very few give much money to writers. I mean, there are a few Guggenheims every year, but I'll say the Lannan Foundation probably gives the most to writers.
And you make a good point in off to the side. You said that because of some of those grants, you end up making enough money that you paid a lot of federal income tax to the government.
Well, yeah, that was curious. If I hadn't had the freedom, I wouldn't have got to pay all those. Unfortunately, paid the IRS during my Hollywood years. That's 10 years ago now, so I'm now a normal human being up to a point. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Jim, before we go today, one of the things that I would like to ask you is, because I've had a lot of listeners have asked me to have you on the show, and one of the questions that I get asked is how you're able to write so well from a woman's point of view.
I don't know. I thought that over. I think, say, if you get out of the culture's box, or, you know, it's like Yeats talking about you cut off the horse's legs to put him into a box stall. Well, it's just, I think we're all everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we all start as women in the womb, you know, cellularly.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an odd idea, but I grew up with, you know, five aunts, sisters, female dogs, chickens, you know, horses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think if we're capable of entering another creature, sometimes as a woman, it's sometimes hard to get out, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
That Woman Led by Fireflies, when I published that in the New Yorker, I think I got 200 letters from women, you know.
Yeah, that had actually done that?
Yeah, that had jumped the fence, as it were.
Yeah,
you know?
That's another gem that we can mention to the listeners is a set of three novellas, Woman Lit by Fireflies, that being the
yeah,
title.
One was an executive lounge at Kennedy, and her husband was at the bar having three double scotches and brain, you know. So she said, I suddenly turned around, walked out, and flew to San Francisco instead of Paris, and I've never seen him again.
I wonder if he knows she's missing.
True lawyer. I love stuff like that. You know, it's that song, Old Freedom.
Yeah, yeah. And Brown Dog has been a recurring character in the novellas, which is a greatly loved character.
Well, that, James, I once said to my doctor that I go to for some traumatic relief for 35 years, and partly to get over the complete being devoured by alcohol and drugs and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, Brown Dog is sort of my survival mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, no, it has to be part of you. But that is true. I grew up, you know, in modest circumstances, and those are the kind of people I know, you know.
Yeah. You know, Jim, and off to the side, you described your life as starting out kind of small, and then the Hollywood years, it became big, and now it seems that you found a size that's comfortable for you.
Well, that's true. You know, the trouble is, no one in my family had ever made any money, and I didn't behave very gracefully. I was the Leon Spinks of the literary world for a while, you know. So it's hard. You know that Dubuque book you thought was fascinating? Because I had always read him, and I was so profoundly irritated when the Times did that appreciation only after he died, you know? He never... But a lot of people don't get their due, let's face it. And he was one that had... And his son's tribute to his father was absolutely remarkable, wasn't it?
Yes, good. I'm glad you enjoyed that book. And, you know, and I did not know that until I had corresponded with Andre for a while that James Lee Burke was his first cousin.
No, I didn't know that either, because I was wondering if there's a genetic element there, because that's three, you know.
Yes.
Andre the third, and then the real Andre, and then James Lee Burke, because I've often wondered that about the Irish. You know, how so many of them write so well.
And I do know that his son is a big admirer of yours, and and his father, you know, getting novellas published is, you know, you go to a publisher with a book of novellas, and it's almost like you have a venereal disease.
Well, that was early, you know. I think I did the breakthrough. I think I published the first book of three novellas in 78 there, and then it's a form convenient for a story you want to tell that's not quite a novel. You know, when Simon Schuster saw the novella Legends of the Fall and immediately suggested I turn it, add 400 pages, and then I could have a real book.
Right,
know?
Right.
That kind of silliness, but I like density in prose. I don't like filler.
Yeah.
Well,
Phil Spitzer, who was Andre's agent, said he gave up when Andre had a story that was 100 pages long and cut it to 11.
Yeah. Some of those people, I go the other way. I think I rarely write a novel or a novella that I haven't thought about for 10 years. So when I when I pull a switch, I'm ready to go. You know,
yeah.
I know what the story is. It's a, you know, just stored in my brain or in my journals, and mostly images rather than ideas, you know. Or mostly characters rather than plot. You know?
Well, Jim, I want to thank you so much for the generous gift of your time today, and I'm delighted that you have another novel finished that we can look forward to next winter. And I assume you probably always have poems going on.
Yeah, you know, this last year or 2 years has been especially productive. You know, you also translate your program into Spanish?
Yes.
Oh, that's a wonderful idea.
Yeah, I found that with Luis Urrea, when I interviewed him about The Hummingbird's Daughter and then The Devil's Highway, I woke up one Sunday and I saw 500,000 people in the street in Los Angeles, and I called Luis up and I said, what's going on? And we decided to do the interview in Spanish and in English.
I was so irked when I got the galley of that novel, which I loved. I got it 6 weeks late, you know.
Yeah.
Where is he now? He's in Phoenix or someplace. Where is he?
Well, he's at the University of Chicago right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and the Hummingbird's Daughter is doing very well in paperback. And
oh, good. This is certainly enormously gifted, you know.
Yeah, I think that The Hummingbird's Daughter, when I read that, I had him on the show about a year and a half ago, and I told the listeners, I said, look, you know, most of the books, I said, you know, a lot of times people say, Casey, it seems like you like all the books that you read. And I said, no, believe me, I read a lot of bad books, but I don't feel the need to interview the authors that write them.
That's a wonderful point of view. You know, I get 200 or 300 galleys a year over the 10-some.
Yeah.
And it's not as bad as people think, because they can usually tell in one page if I'm ever going to read it.
Yeah.
You know?
And when I read The Hummingbird's Daughter, I said, this is a book that people should read, because it was brilliant, it was creative, and the man of research, and, you know, he's writing the sequel to it now.
Oh, is he good?
But it took him 20 years to write.
Like Chicago is easier on me than New York, you know. know.
Yeah.
Chicago's not quite so fond of itself. And, Mark, you know, you can pay $13 for a tuna sandwich in New York.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a bit expensive. But
yeah,
there are great Spanish places there. Casa Mono, I go to.
Yeah. Well, what I'll do is sometime down the road, we can exchange some emails, and you can introduce me to some good Mexican poets, and I can have some of them on the air, and we can get them some exposure.
Well, that would be a good idea. You know, that's interesting, because I could certainly give you a few that I like very much.
Good. And how about this, Jim? How about when the new novel comes out next year, how about if we get in touch then and talk about the new novel when it's released?
Sure. Sure. And meanwhile, I'll do some thinking on Mexican poets and send you a little list, because Michael Weigers would have their phone numbers.
Yeah. Yeah, great. Well, thanks again, Jim. I really appreciate it. And thanks to Joyce Bailey for setting this up.
Okay.
Okay.
Welcome.